I'd like to call this meeting of the Legacy Finance Committee to order. The minutes of our yesterday's meeting, the 23rd, we can't do because we don't have a quorum until we... Oh.
Mr.
We
Chair?
Have a, yes.
I move adoption of the minutes as printed.
Because you saw Anna Wills walk in and knew now we had a quorum, didn't you? Thank you. Minutes have been moved. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? We have passed the minutes. We have several bills up before us today, and we will be starting out with two bills by Representative Dill. I will say that these and other bills will be moved for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And I also will warn you that I'm going to be kind of back and forth today in room 5. The Education Finance Committee is meeting, and I have a bill that I have to present to them, and it just happens to be at the same time as this. So the very able vice chair of the committee, Representative Heinzman, will be conducting some of this meeting today. So with that, Representative Dill, welcome to the committee. You may present your bill.
So, Mr. Chairman, are you going to move the bill before you or just take chairman?
I will lay this bill over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Chairman, this bill is about the Mesaba Trail. This is not a new item here before the Minnesota Legislature. It passes through Itasca and St. Louis counties. It is it affects four members of the legislature in the northern part of the state in terms of their representation. It's one of the more unique trails of its nature and through the area in which it travels. This trail has been funded before with state dollars and should continue to be to do so. That is about all I am going to say about the bill, because the guru of all things Mesaba Trail is here before us today at your pleasure, Mr. Cervenic. And he has been with us since the very infancy and knows all about, and including why the St. Louis County Rail Authority is the agent that operates the trail. And I'm going to ask him to give you a brief overview of the request, and we'll go from there if you have questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Dill. Welcome to the committee. Would you please identify yourself for the tape and then continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Gary Cervenic, and I represent the St. Louis and Lake County Regional Railroad Authority, which is a local government entity that operates and owns the Mesaba Trail, which extends from the Mississippi to the Boundary Waters, 145 miles from Grand Rapids to Ely. Mr. Chairman, a brief overview of the bill, House File 36, is merely an extension of a grant already received by the Mesaba Trail in 2013 for $512,000 from the DNR from legacy funding, and it is for a section of the Mesaba Trail which runs into the entrance of the new state park, Vermilion State Park, near Tower and Lake Vermilion. And the reason for the extension, and it has the support of the DNR, is that the DNR's plan needed to be developed on where the entrance road to the park was, and they ran into some environmental issues and permitting issues. That entrance now has been determined. The route for the Mesaba Trail has been okayed by the DNR through the park. However, we're going to go out for bids in the spring of 2015. We don't think we'll have the construction completed by July 1, which would be the termination of the grant 2015. So we're seeking an extension and to give the DNR the authority to extend the grant so we can complete the trail on time and on budget. Just to give you a little review, I know with respect to your time, it's short, Mr. Chairman, but the Mesaba Trail does run 121 miles by the end of the summer, continuous from Grand Rapids all the way north through Giants Ridge to Highway 135. It's a trail that's been very efficiently built. We have never used eminent domain. We've worked with willing landowners. We've spent less than $100,000 of acquiring property over the entire time period since 1995 on this 121-mile section, just for a couple parcels, and our average cost is about $125,000 per mile.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of any Representative Torkelson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for being here today. There is a provision, I believe, in this year's LCCMR bill regarding the trail. Could you just describe what that will do when and if it passes?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Representative Torkelson, the provision is a $1 million grant for the Mesaba Trail to continue the construction from the eastern edge of Vermilion State Park towards Ely. We currently have about 8 miles of trail completed from Ely to the west, and we have this gap area between the Vermilion State Park and Ely, and that's what the request for $1 million from LCCMR would be used to continue construction towards Ely.
Thank you. Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So how does that interact with this grant extension? I'm just curious if they tie things together or how that works.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Torkelson, this $512,000 would be used from the edge of the state park through the state park towards the other way to the west towards Tower Sedan.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're continuing building the park in sections where we're able to acquire the right-of-way in easements.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And a couple of questions. Your past funding on this, I see you received from the DNR. Have you received any LSART SAMs or what other funding in the past?
Mr. Chairman, since 1995, when the Mesaba Trail was started in construction, we've received money from local property taxes through St. Louis and Lake County Regional Railroad Authority and the Itasca County Regional Railroad Authority, which we operate together. Secondly, we've received money from LCCMR in the past. Thirdly, legacy. And fourth, from DNR grant programs. And fifth, from bonding.
Pretty much whatever's available.
That's right. We're pretty good at it.
Yeah.
Thank you. And we appreciate the support of the committee and the members of the House and Senate and the governor who's supported this on a bipartisan basis for a number of years. And I think people see the vision of the Mesaba Trail as one of the state's premier trails, the longest paved bike trail in the state and done with local effort. And it's not a DNR trail.
Any other questions? Representative Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to continue to support the trail. I've supported it since when I first was elected with you in 2002 and came here in 2003. And one of the reasons is because it's not the trail to nowhere. They do a great job at where needed to put multiple uses on the trail during different parts of the season and working with their local other trail organizations, whether it be snowmobiles or people who are interested in hiking or biking or using it for access to hunting areas and things of that nature. They have done a great job of making this work. And frankly, the extension is because of the new creation of the Vermilion State Park. That is the reason for the extension, because when the park was created, a lot of things have to happen with the park before you can run a trail through it. There has to be a plan for the park, a master plan, then there has to be a trail plan, and there has to be a road plan, and then a trail plan, and for that matter, an outhouse plan. You have to have all these things, and that's been the delay on the House File 36. And so, just asking that you extend that so that we can actually get a premier trail through a premier park.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Well, then, if you have no more comments, this bill will be laid over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
The next bill up.
Part two, Representative Dill.
Right. So I'd ask Mr. Kerfoot to come up. So, members, if I might, the gentleman to come before you and his wife, frankly, in the audience, right there, so Kerfoot, they are legends in the tourism industry, and they operate as far north in the state of Minnesota. They even live more north than I do, and I live on the border because the way the border runs along there, they're actually north of me on the Gunfoot Trail, and they're as close to being in the tip of the Arrowhead by Thunder Bay as you can possibly be, smack dab up against the Canadian boundary and the Boundary Waters Canoe Area Wilderness. north of Grand Marais, a long way north of Grand Marais, 56 miles, I think this location is, north of Grand Marais. And I know you haven't moved the bill before you yet, but I cannot emphasize that Mr. Kerfoot is the sound of the industry when he talks, because let me tell you something that today I learned that I did not know when I had lunch, is that I asked him, I said, how did you fund phase one? Cash. Where'd you get it? I raised it. $1 million. What? You got $1 million to start this thing off and you didn't ask anybody for money? Yeah, I asked a lot of people and they don't like me anymore. So then I said, okay, so this one's 500 and some thousand. I said, where'd you get that? Cash. He said, where from? Same people, different people. So, I mean, this is the real deal. So with that, I'd like to introduce you to Mr. Kerfoot, explain to you that he is a pillar of our community, and only this project would proceed because of he and his wife's persistence. And if you haven't visited their resort on the Gunflint Trail, which is historic in its own right, you've missed something in life. So with that, Mr. Chairman.
Well, Representative Dill, thank you. And as with the other, this bill will be considered for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Mr. Kerfoot, welcome to the committee. Urge you to introduce yourself for the tape. But yes, before you do so, I want to warn you that each time you say A, we will reduce the monetary amount.
Well, he has his roots in Canada a little bit more than I do, so we don't go that direction.
Well, then, okay, then I'm relieved.
Yes.
Mr. Chair?
Just one second. Representative Lilly?
Mr. Chair, I was wondering how much if Representative Dill was a contributor.
I'd be glad to answer that.
Representative Dill?
There will be a membership application in the mail soon.
Yes, I can assure you that I will be hit along with Senator Bach, because the radio station just got us this week. So, but at this moment, only the soles of my feet have put in any equity.
Okay, thank you, Representative Dill. Mr. Kerfoot.
Chairman Udall and your committee, I'm Bruce Kerfoot, a representative of the Gunflint Trail Historical Society. And our little group started about 10 years ago. I'll give you just a quick synopsis, just a quick snapshot here. About 10 years ago, we were in the normal country way lamenting a little bit about how history was fading in our community, and there were few of us remaining that still knew of its beginning and the pieces that fit. And it kind of came to even a more of a head when a couple of my guests were chatting with me, and we got to talking about the Voyageurs, and they looked at me and they said, is that funny woodsman guy you've got on your logo? They didn't have a clue what I was talking about with the Voyageur. And then a little bit further in our conversation, we were talking about how back in the days when I first was up there with my family when I was a little guy, we had root cellars because we wintered in, and that's what you did, and that's how you lived. And they looked at me and said, what's a root cellar? And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, we got holes here. Fast forward a little bit, we end up with a new supervisor, Jim Sanders, at the U.S. Forest Service, looking after the Superior National Forest. He inventoried what he had for buildings that he wasn't using, and he came up with a question mark about the Chickwack Lodge, which was a rock lodge building left from the remnants of a resort taken out at the end of the Boundary Waters legislative issues of the late 70s. And the bingo, a couple of things came together. He was receptive, very receptive. We put our act together. We formed our little society, about 30 spearheaders. You know, we turned around twice and we had 200 members. We quickly picked up a 20-year lease and we got it on the National Registry, and we went into phase one. Phase one grew a little bit as we got a little bit wiser, because at first glance we didn't have a clue about how to build a country museum. Except we knew we didn't want dusty glass cases full of junk, and that we expected people to come to see that. Ultimately, we learned there are companies that build museums, and that's all they do in their life. We have one of the premier ones in Minnesota, Split Rock Studios, here in the North Twin Cities. Well, when they got through with us, we started to drool, because what they do was a class act. They just finished the Ford Museum in the East Coast here recently, rebuilding some of the exhibits, and that's the class in which they operate. Well, that raised the bar. We raised our budget. We went out and got our own money. I did find some money in some granting sources. I got a little ICT money. I got a little bit of out of RRRB, a little bit out of Johnson. The Historical Society assisted us with some money for some exhibits. But we put together $1 million. We got off to a roaring start. We're at the end of a 56-mile road from Grand Marais, dead end. The first year, we attracted 10,000 visitors. We're now sustaining ourselves, having operated for 5 years, we're running at 9,000 visitors each summer. And we think that somewhat speaks to itself as to the quality of what we have and the interest that people have that come to the North that are interested in our Northwoods heritage and culture and stuff. So, we also, just to give you a little fill-in, because of this partnership relationship with the Forest Service, was one of the first major projects we've had in partnership in northern Minnesota in many, many supervisors' terms of duty. They submitted this project to a national award system for consideration, and we ended up being the premier award for the nation from the Forest Service on a collaborative project between the private sector and the agency. They figured they found it to be so prominent that they gave us the national standard of it. We have a 20-year lease on it, but we own our own improvements. So everything we're doing construction-wise is owned by our society. The Chickwack is the only remaining example we've got of kind of what the old days and the pioneer days looked like. So there's a decent build-out that is putting together some things that have a lot of foundation to them. And what it does, it's a very encompassing message that we give there, because it deals all the way from the Native Americans to the first trappers and prospectors and miners that first came through the area, mines that didn't work out because they didn't have what they thought they had up there. And then, of course, on to the current day and age with the people that are there. We have done our due diligence in the sense that we are on the registry, but we went out and did a cultural landscape review in concert with the Historical Society here in Minneapolis or in St. Paul. And we got that completed. And the plan we have before us in phase two is totally in sync with that review, and that's in being supported by the Forest Service and the SHPO office here at the Historical Society. This phase will encompass 5 buildings. It'll move us into a nice little campus. One of it is a very necessary nature interpretive center, which right now all our lecture talks are on an open-air porch with mosquitoes, wind, and rain. We're not doing so good that way. But this building will take care of that need. We'll also have a roofed boat pavilion, and we're doing a collaborative project with the North House School in Grand Marais, and they're going to have a class on timber frame construction, and that's going to mitigate the costs of that one, and we'll help put it all together, and that will be our boat display. Then we'll have a little administrative building, not plush, but a little bit for the administrator, a little bit for climate-controlled archive work, which we don't have presently. There will be a building representing a reconstructed cabin from the early era to show people what the accommodations were like. And then, of course, a little bit of a logistical support building, a maintenance building that we have to have. The 5 buildings will cost us $500,000. We have raised, or I have gone out in the last 12 months and raised $250,000 of it. So we have half of it in our pocket. I'm struggling at this point, and I can't find the other half. And that's why I'm knocking on your door for the first time. Because we're pretty proud of what we do up there, and we don't come looking if we haven't dug in our own pockets first. And we're serious about digging in our pockets first. And I have got good, stiff financial backers that believe in the success of our museum and what we've got going. The economic impact of this project will tickle our community a little bit in a very positive way. I'm expecting that this project will take a small construction crew of 3 to 4 people, and it will give them 1 year's employment, because it'll take us about a year to do the build-out. That's in addition to the heavy contracting equipment for the foundation work, the electricians, and some of the other support guys. These are all very good-paying jobs. These are not minimum wage type. These are $22 to $45 an hour per person jobs. The economic impacts also have an interesting repercussion, because about half our visitors come to us from the North Shore. People staying at the Bluefin, at Tofte, Lutzen, Schroeder, and those properties. Well, one of the struggles that those properties have is the average length of stay of their visitor. Because it's nice to come up and look at Lake Superior, but you can't do much with it once you get there. So they actually, within tourism, have the shortest average length of stay of any area in the whole state. A little under 2 nights average. Well, anybody coming from them to Chickwack spends a full day on the Gunflint Trail. driving up, doing the museum. We have the longest average visit of a museum, I think, in the whole state. They come and stay for hours. None of these short turnarounds, because we have so much that's fascinating to them. Anyway, we're going to be solely responsible for extending the average length of the visitation of a whole variety of properties along the North Shore, which economically will contribute on a nice long-term basis. And that's in addition to the logic of the museum being there for the resorts along the Gunflint Trail or the summer home visitors, because on windy and rainy days, this is slick as a whistle for them to come and get their culture of the moment. We've also expanded it to include a variety of hiking trails up to Blueberry Hill, up to the edges of the Boundary Waters. Beautiful recreational components to go along with the museum exhibits internally. And that includes the birding trail, the wildflower trail, all kinds of neat things. We have a very ambitious society of membership. They're very supportive financially and with enthusiasm. And we respectfully ask for your support to help us get phase two under control and on its way for the people of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr.
Questions?
Yes. Do members have any questions? I'll go ahead and ask a question then, if it's all right. I was just wondering, have we approached any other organizations and agencies for help with this project besides Legacy? Aside from the money you have raised already, I'm wondering if there's other organizations.
Within that $250,000 that I've raised, I've gotten $20,000 from the IRRRB, which is the limits that they have on their little fund that deals with this type of facility. I have a grant from the Johnson Foundation in Duluth. And what else have I got? I think the rest of it is all private money that I've raised.
I guess I was thinking specifically along the lines of like the Historical Society.
I went to them, and the issue there is that their money within the description of the legacy money, their definition of usability or of suitable projects is exhibits only and not hardware. So they turned me down because I had such a large proportion of our budget going to buildings that it doesn't fit their definition. So I tried them first.
Representative Dill.
Thank you. One other key question I think that could be asked, so I will ask it. How are you going to pay for it after it's built, Mr. Kerfoot? I mean, how are you going to run it?
I know. I gave him a surprise at lunchtime when he threw that one at me, and I got him to gasp. We have a balanced budget. We operate with the income that we generate, and we balance our budget every year, and we do without any outside help, grants, or gifts from anybody, in exclusive of our membership, because we obviously have a small membership, which is a part of how we gather together our operating funds. We have a tidy little gift shop that contributes nicely, and we have a small gate fee to get in. But we see that we operate in a balanced budget. We do not do any grants for year-to-year operating funds.
All right. Any other questions from members?
Yeah, closing item. I want to just remind you that this, Mr. Chairman, this proposal is more remote than I even live, and I live on an island in Voyageurs National Park. I mean, if you want to get there, you have to want to get there. Seriously, I don't have visitors at my house unless they call me first, because they don't want to make sure I'm home, right? Come by boat or snowmobile or however. The people have to go to Grand Marais, leave Bluefin Bay or any of those wonderful places that are very homey and relaxing and looking at this beautiful lake, and want to drive to Grand Marais to town, and then want to go 56 miles up a two-lane road, which you're liable to see any amount of wildlife, to the very end to go to this, and he still has 9,000 visitors a year. This is not like something I envisioned. We also have in our legislative district the Wolf Center and the Bear Center. And this is minuscule in terms of funding compared to what they ask for, with an incredible bang. No disrespect to them, but the size and dynamics of the two are very different. And I am confident that when my friend Mr. Kerfoot says that he will pay for this himself to operate it into the future and not come to Tom Bach and I for IRRRB money to pay some deficit, I am confident that that will happen because that's the way his life has been. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Seeing none, I will renew my motion. I should say I, as a new chair, would motion that House File 461 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you for the time. Appreciate it.
Next is Representative Shaw.
Am I up, Mr. Chair? Are we in the right direction?
All right.
Supposed to be here?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Well, I almost teared up at Representative Dill. I mean, that was moving testimony right there, wasn't it? Well, I got to tell you, that
it's
guy.
A high bar.
That guy. Well, we're not as far north, Mr. Chair, so I'll wait for your motion to move the bill here.
I'll go ahead and motion to move House File 166 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you. That was kind of you. Well, good afternoon.
I misspoke. Just a second.
Oh.
House File 84. My apologies.
You want and you wanted
to, we wanted to
you wanted
right
to
bill.
Move on to the general registry or no? Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon, everybody. I really want to thank you for the time to take that you sit here and listen to House File 84. Today we're going to talk about a bill that is going to improve the water quality, restore essential backwater habitat in this very important part of the Mississippi River leads into my district and Representative McNamara's district. Here today I have Richard Adams, who's the town board chair of Great Cloud Island Township. I've also got Matt Moore with the South Washington County Watershed, and we have Wayne Sandberg and maybe some other folks related to the area that this involved. But before I turn it over to Mr. Adams, I want to reinforce that this project is important not only to the citizens of Great Cloud Island Township, but for our entire region. This portion of the Mississippi River is a national park, river, and recreation area. Additionally, the area where the habitat will see the most improvement is on the state water trail system. And finally, this is an area designated as a future regional park for everybody in the state to enjoy. So improvements made here will serve a broad, broad section of the public. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Adams of Great Cloud Island Township, who is my favorite constituent, who is sitting to my immediate left today. And what a great guy. So thanks for coming. Scoot over here, Mr. Adams, and you can take the microphone.
Oh, there's one right here.
Go ahead.
Yeah. And would you, Mr. Adams, please introduce yourself for the record.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. My name is Richard Adams, and I am the elected chair of the Great Cloud Island Township Town Board. And I'm also landowner on this body of water that Representative Shonan and the bill is here to represent. And I've lived there since 1994, and I've witnessed the gradual degradation of this this body of water to a point where it's starting to match its name. The maps from the 1930s call it Great Cloud Slough, which is the backwater side of a at that time a large island in the Mississippi River. And the loss of gradual loss of habitat, ability to for people to navigate this waterway have evolved into large algae blooms and all kinds of very, very, very bad things. So we're here from the township to ask your help in helping to fund this project so that we can restore this waterway, restore the natural habitat, the spawning of the game fish, and all the other things that Representative Schoen has said. This is a connection to a future regional park. This waterway will be imperative for the success of that park. It will allow access to the main river, Mississippi River, and I guess that's about as much as I can say. If anyone has any questions, I'll be happy to try.
Members, any questions? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Representative Shaw. I'm just curious why the county commissioner's not here to speak for this.
Well, boy, by golly, thanks for asking, Mr. Representative Lilly. Mr. Chair, Commissioner Bigham sends her regrets, but she's doing the people's work elsewhere today, trying to make sure that Washington County, of which you represent as well, is represented and taken care of at the federal level. So she does send her regrets and really appreciates everybody's time in attention to this issue, which I was going to bring up at the end, but I thank you for bringing that up.
Representative Kahn.
Well, Mr. Chairman, doesn't Commissioner Bigham thinks it makes a difference whether she's here or not? Shouldn't she have asked for another day?
Well, Representative Mr. Chair and Representative Kahn, I really appreciate that we're talking about her so she can watch this video and realize that we're really harping on her. But she wants to make sure that when you come down to visit our district, which I hope is soon, that you have clean recreational water. It's going to be fantastic, but you should come soon. And I'll, in fact, you can stay at Carla's house.
That's fantastic. I actually have a question. In regard to some of the work that we're going to be doing in restoring this backwater area, what kind of activity do you expect will be taking place in that process?
Thank you for asking, Mr. Chair. I got a great guy over to my left that's going to probably touch on a little bit of that. And I think I'll let him do that.
Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Matt Moore. I'm the administrator with the South Washington Watershed District. And the Watershed District, in partnership with the township and the county, have been working on this project for probably about 4 or 5 years now. The district completed a feasibility study to look at restoring the backwater. And it is a vital component of the river. This is one of the areas in that stretch of river where much of the backwater areas exist, and they're very important for spawning and rearing of fish, as well as overwintering. So the project itself is really to restore flow. In 1965, when the flood occurred, after the flood, the causeway was built, and cutting off flow from the main channel through this backwater area. And so our proposal is to restore the flow, and actually just restoring the flow through that backwater will indeed do the restoration work itself. So just that natural flow through there will create and restore, improve that water quality, and restore that habitat.
So I think I'm going to boil down a little bit closer, because on my own Watershed District Board, we've had some difficulties in obtaining permits, and I just was curious if you've had any of those kinds of difficulties or if you believe the process is on track and working for your district.
Actually, Mr. Chair, we do believe the process is on track. All the agencies are on board. We had a technical advisory committee, and so we have support from the Corps of Engineers, the DNR, National Park Service. Everybody's on board with creating this project. It's also been included in the Corps' study of Pool 2 as a project. So the project has popped up in numerous plans out there, and so we do have the support.
All right. Any other questions from members? All right. Seeing no other questions, I renew my motion that House File 84 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. And I do want to extend an invitation that County Commissioner and former Representative Bigham made to everybody. If anybody would like to take the tour, come down and see this project, she would personally invite everybody, including the audience that's in attendance today, to her home for dinner at night, and whatever you request, she will make. So I think that's pretty kind. Thank you.
And I have a boat, and I'd be happy to show you the problem.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Next, we are going to hear House File 166, Representative Kahn. All right, I would like to now bring House File 166 before the committee. Okay. Representative Kahn, would you like to
move
House File?
Okay. I'll move that it be laid over for
possible inclusion?
For possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
We're both rookies at this.
Well, what this does is this follows along with one of the thoughts that I've had for quite a while about legacy funds and this whole issue of supplementing and supplanting, is that people are, as we've heard from the previous testifiers, people are usually interested in using legacy funds for new projects, for new acquisitions, for and usually fairly expensive. This is just to one of the things that we've seen is the usefulness of what the legislative auditor does, and and my theory has been is that we should definitely use legacy funds to going to the legislative auditor to clarify the funding of the study of legislative projects. So the current law allows the legislative auditor to seek reimbursement for the cost of auditing the four legacy funds. But this and the reimbursement gets reimbursed, and the reimbursement goes into the general fund. This would go directly into the legislative auditor to recover the costs of the audit. So we would be sure we wouldn't be interfering with other general fund issues and so forth, and it would have a clearer process of the reimbursement for the account. And the legislative auditor is here to answer any questions about how this would work.
Thank you, Representative Kahn. Any questions from members?
It's a good idea.
All right. I guess I would just have some whispering in my ear, as you noticed. is the legislative auditor going to speak to this?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Jim Nobles, legislative auditor. I guess the only statement I'd like to make is to thank Representative Kahn. Just give you a very quick bit of background. When the 2008 Legacy Amendment was passed, enacted, approved by the voters, we certainly saw that we had a big, new, important responsibility in terms of oversight and auditing. We did not ask and we did not receive additional funding, so we prioritized within our existing budget to do audit work. We have produced 11 audits since the amendment was enacted. We just completed and issued today, yesterday actually, an audit we did on the Clean Water Fund, money expended by the Board of Water and Soil Resources and the Pollution Control Agency. So this is something we have been doing that we will continue to do, but it is work that then means we don't do something else. And so we only have so much money. We prioritize our budget and our work on a strategic basis. We certainly rank any work on the legacy money as a high priority because it is something that you very diligently deal with each legislative session in terms of where you appropriate that money and specifically how you want it used. And so we take that standard that you establish and go do these audits. We will continue to do that, but Representative Kahn's bill would help. It would probably give us in the range of $60,000 to $70,000 in terms of reimbursement for the work we do that would then allow us to do audits of other organizations or programs in state government. So thank you again to Representative Kahn, and thank you to the committee.
And thank you to
Mr. Nobles. Representative Kahn.
And thank you to Mr. Nobles for explaining it much more clearly than I could.
And just to be clear, so I'm understanding correctly, we expect this to cost between $50,000 and $70,000. Is that what you said?
Mr. Chairman and members, each audit is somewhat different. I think that's a reasonable range. I might mention, too, that this money now is, as Representative Kahn said, taken out of the legacy funds and put back into the general fund. So the net loss, I think, to the legacy funds per se is I don't think there is a net loss. It simply means that that money will be coming into our budget so that we can use the recovery to to pay for other audit work.
All right, very good. I'll just ask again, any questions from members? All right. Seeing no additional questions or testimony, Representative Heintzman moves that House File 166 be laid over for inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks.
Could Representative Kale come, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. I would move that we move House File 618 for possible inclusion.
Thank you. Thank you, members. with me, this is a Riverwatch watershed or water program for educational reasons. And rather than my explaining a whole lot about this, I have people that do this daily and live with this. So I think it's a great program. We have been doing it for years. It has a real interconnection, and I am going to let the people that work on this best explain to you what the Riverwatch program is. So first of all, I have with me Mr. Wayne Gokin, who is Gokin, right? I apologize. I should have known that. You always think you know, and then you look at it and go, is that right? But anyway, he's a special programs coordinator for the International Water Institute and comes from my district up in, I don't know if you know where Erskine, Minnesota is, but anyway, that's up in my area. So I know Representative Daniels is from Bagley, so that's just down the road, members. So anyway, Mr. Gokin, I'll let you speak.
Mr. Gokin, please state your name for the record.
Yeah, Wayne Gokin, I'm Special Projects Coordinator with the International Water Institute, and I'll just give a brief background on the Riverwatch program, and then I'll turn it over to some of our team members from Campbell Tinta. The program began back in 1995 in the Sandhill Watershed District, my home watershed, with four schools, and it was based on the need from the local watershed that needed water quality data for a project they were advancing, and they had nothing in their arsenal for that, so we started the Riverwatch program, and with the four schools that were on the Sandhill River. And the emphasis was that they needed good sound quality data, so the underpinnings was a very scientifically sound base that we started with, so that the data could be useful for decision making. But the interest was also in providing wonderful field-based hands-on education experience for the students as well. So that kind of has gone twofold throughout the years. And while we've filled in a lot of gaps in the data needs for the Northwest Minnesota and the Red River Basin, and we coordinate with the agencies and where we do our monitoring, and so it's a unified system. But the main thing is the educational focus, to provide the students with some opportunities to get exposure to natural resource fields, to some of the STEM skills that the equipment and the procedures that we're training them in provides. It's advanced equipment that the agencies use, and we do the same training with the students as we do with professionals. We're the only area of the state that has a certification program for water quality professionals going out and taking samples in the field. And with all that, the students have, we've developed a number of different activities that they can get involved with, and I think I'll let the students talk about some of the activities they're involved with in a moment. But it really has provided a great deal of opportunity for the local school districts that really don't have access to that type of equipment. And a lot of our graduates or alumni from the Riverwatch program have certainly gone into STEM careers and advanced those career opportunities. So with that, I think I'm going to turn it over to the Campbell Tinta Riverwatch team to start with, and they can talk about their experiences, and I'll maybe come back and talk a little bit about some of the other activities, some of the new wrinkles we're adding to the program for more opportunities for the students to get engaged in their own local watersheds.
Well, I would welcome the both of you, and whichever would like to go first, state your name for the record.
I'm Brandon Meyer, and I'm a senior from Campbell Tinta School, And I've been involved with River Rot for 5 years. And over the course of those 5 years, when there's open water, we measure 11 different sites along the Rabbit River. And we measure for pH levels, dissolved oxygen levels, transparency. And during the winter, we measure frost depths. And we also measure the water content in the snow. And that information is used to predict flooding in the spring. From the data that we collect throughout the year, there is an annual River Watch Forum at the University of Minnesota Crookston that we create a poster for, our team does, and we present all that information to scientists. And we also use that poster and present the information that we've collected to our Bois de Sioux Watershed Board. In the past, we've created demonstrations for the elementary students at our school based on their level. So kindergarten, it would be a little bit simpler than fifth and sixth grade, so they know what we're doing and create a little bit interest as when they get older so they can join the group. I guess for a little bit more specifics, I'll give it to Skylar.
State your name for the record.
I'm Skylar Nishi. I'm also a senior at Camel Tinta. I've also been in it for about 5 years. For part of the elementary, what we do for them, our snow study sites are on our playground. We have a frost tube and a snowboard where we take snow cores. We have a water gauge and then a filtration tube in there, too. What we do is kind of like a reward for them to not touch it when they're at recess. We basically explain to them the frost tube and like the effects with flooding and stuff. Our information for snow studies is actually used in predicting flood outcomes. We measure the amount of water. We take cores and we melt down the snow, and we actually measure the amount of water in the snow. And we take that and compare it against how far the ground is froze down with our frost tubes. And if the ground is froze down a lot and we have a lot of water content in the snow, then it's going to run off. It's not going to go down in the dirt. So then that is help. We send it into COCORAS, and it's used in flood predictions. And with our sites, our information is used by the state. It gets sent in. A lot of our members, we have two or three members go every year to go get certified at UMC. We're certified just as any other adult who does this professionally is. We're certified to calibrate our SON and take this data and use it and send it in. We sample once a month all 11 sites every month that we can get in the water. So even if it's snowing or raining or really cold or hot, it's a little miserable sometimes, but it's still worth it in the end. We've learned a lot. Stuff like this we wouldn't have done any other time for anything in school. I mean, we're both in a lot of extracurricular activities like speech and basketball and stuff like that, but we never would have had an opportunity like this without Riverwatch. We learn a lot about using data and stuff like that, and even teaching the younger kids about what we do. We like to present to our school board and to our watershed district every year, and then also at the forum. In the past 2 years, we won which awards did we win?
Won a number of awards.
Yeah, we've won quite a few awards in the past 2 years. We've been trying to work at it really hard. It takes up a lot of time, but we like it. I mean, some nights when it comes around to getting ready for the forum, we're at school until the server shuts down, working on our poster, and it's a lot of early mornings and late nights when it gets around to forum time, but we really enjoy it.
Nice work. Representative Kahn, you have a question.
Yes, I have a question. It's actually kind of on another bill I have, but I'd like to know how old both of the young people who testified are, and when they started working on this. How old were they when they started working on this project?
Ms. Skiller.
Oh, we're both 18, and we were 13 or 14 when we started. Okay. So we started middle school.
I'm just using that in defense of my bill to allow 16-year-olds to vote. Don't you think these guys would have been much better voters than most of the voters that we see? Okay, thank you. Sorry, I had hoped you were under 18, but, you know, you can't have everything.
Mr. Chair, I also have joined us as their instructor, and I thought maybe he would like to address the committee and explain, share with us how it works for him.
All right. Please identify yourself to the committee.
My name is Roy Maeda, and I'm the secondary science instructor for Campbell Tinta. It's a small school, so I teach everybody from 7th grade up. We actually have, I guess, well, now with the new recruits, at about 10 to 11, we've got probably 20% of the student body actually participating in Riverwatch in the secondary level. It's a really small school. I can't really add maybe really all that much to as far as the mechanics of the program. The kids have done a great job of that.
I might actually have a question then, if you don't mind.
Oh, yes.
Specifically in regard to what you're trying to accomplish here, are we sending out these water samples to a lab, or is that what we're trying to do? Are we trying to do some of this testing in-house?
We do have a couple components to it. We have all the Riverwatch groups do not so much what we would officially call sampling. They do monitoring, and so they will measure the turbidity, the clarity of the water. They'll measure the pH, so the acidity. They'll measure oxygen content and temperature. We have a couple of sites that we're using. One's an experimental site and one is a control site. They're studying the specific influence of tile drainage water. The watershed district is interested in finding out whether subsurface drainage contributes to any issues with water quality. Right now, the results, we've been doing that for a couple of years. Those are actual samples that are pulled and sent to a state-approved lab up in Detroit Lakes. And those are examined for several ions. And right now we don't have, I suppose what one would call conclusive evidence, really, one way or the other, of what the effect of tile drainage is. It's been going on for a couple of years now, the study, and it takes quite a number of years to amass enough data to find out what actually happens when one installs a tile drainage system.
So is this work being done then in coordination with the watershed district?
Correct. The watershed district, the Bois de Sioux watershed district, they basically underwrite the cost that they will pay for my substitute. They buy us lunch when we go out. Their work, because they're working for them at that point. They are gathering data. So the watershed district has that as a specific project in addition to the general monitoring. That's why we have 11 sites. I believe we have nine sites, I believe, that not involving those specific measurements. So those would be our general Riverwatch sites.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry I was out of the room. I didn't get your name.
Oh, I'm sorry, Roy Maeda.
Roy, could you tell me what you are sampling, what tests you're running on that tile water that you're sampling?
On the tile water, they submit for a combination nitrate-nitrite level, for chloride ion, for sulfate ion, for total phosphorus content, for orthophosphorus, which is dissolved phosphorus available content, and total suspended solids. Those are the items that they're looking for at this point. And that was basically in conjunction with the discovery of fairly high conductivity levels that showed that there were a lot of dissolved materials in some of that water. We wanted to know what it was. In fact, the Riverwatch students actually were asking the questions about, well, what's actually making that happen? It was off scale. In fact, at Skyler's, that was your very first presentation, I believe, at Crookston. One of their judges was, now I'm blanking on his name, I can see him, Bruce Pock from MPCA. He's one of their lead limnologists. And he told them that their values at that site couldn't possibly be correct. They were off by an order of magnitude. And I had to catch him later on and say, no, actually, the students know what they're talking about. It's a special monitoring project. And so he was he was quite impressed with their knowledge and their abilities. And we didn't win an award that year, but as a teacher, that was better. I thought that was probably the proudest moment I had. Is he actually, normally when they present an award, they just call the school. He actually called our two presenters up by name and acknowledged them in front of all the other students there. So they're pretty good. And that was she was an eighth grader, and her partner was a ninth grader.
Follow up.
No, I'm done. Thank you.
Representative Wills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm curious, for our young testifiers, if you enjoy this so much, do you think you might pursue this as a career in the future?
Well, I have considered it before. My plan actually right now is to go to school to become an art teacher, but my plan changes varying by the year. I know it has affected the choices of some of our members who graduated last year. I know one of them is my close friends, and I was up there at their college visiting them, and they said they were writing a paper for comp, and they had to write something about the classes and stuff they did in high school, how it affected or how it helped them in their career and stuff like that. And he couldn't really think of anything. I'm like, well, Riverwatch, I mean, you've learned data and you've learned how the chemicals and stuff affect our water and runoff and stuff like that. We've learned about pH and all that stuff. And he's going to school to be aviation. So he's learning about all these crop and weed and chemicals and stuff like that. And so we're learning about how all that stuff affects our rivers with the tile drainage. And a few years ago, we actually had a site that somebody told us that it was on Highway 55. I can't remember the site name right now. But it actually looked like pus. The water looked like pus, and it smelt very, I don't know how to explain. It was really bad.
Disgusting.
It was gross. And I really didn't want to touch it, but we had to. And when we sampled there, we saw that in our data that there was, like, no dissolved oxygen. That means nothing was living in the water. And that the pH levels were way off. And so, I mean, you could see that's what's wrong with it, but then when you look at the data, you realize, oh, there's nothing living in that water right now. And MPCA was contacted. Evelyn and Wayne helped us. They got it, and they traced it to the source, and it was actually beet runoff. That year, the beets rotted because of it was so warm when they were hauling them in, and they didn't stop the hauling in enough days. So the beets ended up rotting from the inside of the pile. After that year, a lot of them installed fans, but they rotted, and so they're having farmers spread them around in their fields, and it was running off, the juice was running off, and it was polluting our river. So we found that, and there ended up being a fine. But
I suppose more important than the fine, even, that some of what you mentioned about that they've installed chillers and some of those changes that they've enacted, the co-op there, that was actually also a result of that investigation. So that was something that they grabbed onto, and I remember that day driving around. We had gone off for the end of our day. We had to grab our lunch, and on the way back, I said, well, we do have a little bit of time before the end of school, so since students had to catch the bus, we went and followed it as far as we could, and so we gave all the information as to where we had found traces of those signs. So they were doing real field science like they usually do. So,
there are any other questions from members? All right. Seeing no additional questions or testimony, I renew my motion that House File 618 be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Keel.
Can I? I just wanted to make a point here. First of all, this is a program that runs up and down the Red River Valley, well as southern, because the beet company they're talking about is even quite as far south of mine. But there are 28 programs. It has expanded, and actually has produced some students at the university, which is always great for students to come back to Crookston and go to the university there. But also the important part is that it's quite an educational program, and they're working toward protecting and taking care of the valley or the area. So, with that, I thank you for it. It'll be laid over, correct?
That's right. Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. So next, House File 636, Schumacher. Chair would move House File 636 be laid over for possible inclusion. Mr. Schumacher, Representative Schumacher.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. House File 636 is a request of $60,000 from the legacy account to fund an expansion of the Fulda Heritage Society, which will tie into the Southwest Heritage Tourist Trail. The funds for this project will be used to expand the display area in Fulda to include donated artifacts. The display would add to what the Fulda Heritage Society has already developed in historical preservation, including the Fulda Depot, which was placed on the National Register of Historic Places in 1979, the old soldier statue that was constructed in 1896 to commemorate Fulda's fallen Civil War soldiers, a train caboose, restored 3-inch ordnance rifle that was used in the U.S. Dakota War of 1862, environmental rain garden, Veterans Memorial Beach, and a bathhouse that was dedicated to the veterans of World War I. House File 636 would continue the preservation of the area's history. The money would be used for a building to display donated artifacts. The plan for the building was already drawn, and the land has been plotted along the way. Finally, the display building would not only tie into Fulda Heritage Society projects, but into the Greater Southwest Heritage Tourist Trail. This trail includes sites from all around southwest Minnesota, from Worthington to Fulda, Slayton, Slaughter Slough, Pipestone, and Laverne. Unfortunately, due to current health considerations, the leading members of the Fulda Heritage Society were not able to make it in attendance today and offer you more details. However, I will be glad to pass along any comments or questions individual members may have. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your consideration.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, is there a local match to this? Have the locals been raising some money for this project?
Representative Schumacher.
The locals have been raising some money, Mr. Chair, and Representative Torkelson. I don't know what those amounts are, but as they continue throughout their whole society mission, they're raising money that way. But I'm not sure what the local match is, but I will get that to you.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Schumacher, with the fangled phone here, I happened to Google the community of Fulda, and I really enjoy the depot. So is this part of this project tied then to the depot building, or because you're using the depot building, I think it said something for history items now, and just a question there.
Right. Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly, thank you for the question and for your research into this. It would be part of that. It's just they've run out of room for what the artifacts that they're getting would entail.
Representative Lilly.
Mr. Chair and Representative Schumacher, I encourage folks to look at it. It's really a neat building. The old depot and really is neat that they're reusing it and then tying into the trail. I think that'll be a great use. And it's funny, with my community, we used to have a train depot way back when. We lost ours, and it's now at the state fair grounds, but you're much more blessed having it still in your community, and what a treasure. I'm just curious, do you have an idea how many trail riders or users will be able to use the trail? And then is there some like a B&B or some other kind of component so if folks were to come down and hop on the trail, if they could stay over and those sort of things? I'm sure there's some economic interest in tourism and those sort of things. But
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Lilly. I don't have details on the trail itself. From my understanding, it's not like we think of trails as they are, but it's just avenues for historic sites as it is right now. So people are able to tour it now without actually having a trail in place, like a bike trail or anything. It's from my understanding, just how they named it.
Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Schumacher, so it's more of like a historic trail, so it would be like a map and you would drive from one. So, okay. Thank you very much.
Representative Torkelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Schumacher, has the Fulda Heritage Society applied for or received any grants from the Minnesota Historical Society grant program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Torkelson, not to my knowledge.
Thank you.
Any more questions from members? Seeing no additional questions or testimony, I renew my motion that House File 636 be laid over for possible inclusion.
Thank you, Chair and members.
It's very good.
Ooh. Oh. Ooh. Nice. Taking over.
That's power.
I've been waiting the whole time for this part.
Fresh power.
All right. Seeing that we have conducted the business of the Legacy Committee today, I would conclude by saying, well, King, this case is closed.
Good job.
Wow.